The Exchange Daily Podcast is brought to you by
Doucette Survey, serving your professional land surveying and mapping needs in New England, now with offices in New Hampshire and Maine. Information at doucetsurvey.com. That's doucetsurvey.com.
And Dartmouth Hitchcock, creating a new model for healthcare where leading health systems collaborate to improve care for all of us. A sustainable system improving the health of our communities for years to come. Information at imagine.d-h.org.
And Northeast Credit Union, helping their members save money through free checking accounts and refinancing of auto, home, and personal loans. Northeast Credit Union, encouraging you to discover the difference at necu.org. Federally insured by NCUA, equal housing opportunity.
Enjoy the show.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. It's been a hot summer for the Northern Pass Project. A few weeks ago, the Federal Department of Energy weighed in with a draft environmental impact statement. And then this week, a huge announcement from the project's New Hampshire partner, Eversource Energy, that 52 more miles of power line would be buried, bringing the total to 60, roughly a third of the total length. That change was one of several in an updated plan the company calls Forward New Hampshire. Other enticements include cash for North Country economic development and a promise that customers will pay the lowest rates possible for this electricity. But these concessions may not be enough to ease the concerns of Northern Pass opponents, even though some call it a good first step toward what they really want, burial of the whole thing, almost 200 miles, stretching from Pittsburgh to Deerfield. Today in The Exchange, what's next for Northern Pass? Let's hear from you. The Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. We have four guests for the hour with us in studio, Sam Evans-Brown, NHPR's environment reporter. Sam, thank you for taking time out.
Good morning, Laura.
Also with us, Allie Morris, reporter for the Concord Monitor, who has been covering this issue extensively for the paper. Allie, thank you also.
Thanks.
Also with us, Ken Kimball, director of research for the Appalachian Mountain Club. Ken, welcome. Good to see you.
Thanks a lot.
And also with us, Bill Quinlan, president of New Hampshire Operations for Eversource. And Bill, thank you for being here.
Thank you, Laura.
Well, and I want to start with you, Sam. How big a change is this, the New Hampshire Forward Plan?
So I think the biggest change that everyone's going to be pointing to is the 52 new miles of buried line that goes through the White Mountain National Forest along state roads. It's significant because it's more buried line, which has been what opponents have been pushing for, but also because it's going to mean increased revenue to the state. There's going to be some sort of lease agreement, which I'm sure we'll see later on down the line, in which Eversource talks about how it's going to be reimbursing the state for using the roads in that way. But there's a number of other smaller changes as well. There's a jobs fund that's been announced. They're also talking about a purchase power agreement, which is, once we see the details of that, is going to enumerate exactly how much power is going to be flowing to New Hampshire customers. And then there's 5,000 acres of land, which Eversource has purchased up in the North Country. They're going to be putting it to mixed uses. They haven't, again, been super specific in exactly what that is, but they've got all this land that they bought in order to make the project, and they're gonna give it back in some way. And then the sort of nerdiest point is they're upgrading this thing called the COAS Loop, which is a transmission infrastructure up in the North Country, which has been historically not super great. And there's one in particular, a wind farm up there, which has suffered and not been able to sell its power at certain times because of the quality of that transmission.
Oh, interesting. Okay. And someone sent me an email actually about that COAS Loop this morning. So we'll talk about that in a minute. But to you too, Allie Morris, why is the additional 50 plus lines of burial getting so much of the attention?
Yeah, well, I think, as Sam said, you know, one of the key concerns that opponents had was that, you know, the tall utility towers, some spanning 120 feet, especially through an area like the White Mountain National Forest, would really mar the landscape. People were concerned about tourism. You know, that's one of the big drivers in New Hampshire's economy. And so now that, you know, a significant amount of miles are being buried through this critical area, I think the goal is to try to get more people on board. You know, I think it remains to be seen how much public support this will get. You know, people who say that this hydropower is necessary to help lower costs here, you know, are obviously excited that this is moving forward. But I think some of the opponents still are concerned that, you know, 130 miles are still going to be overhead. And there's been questions raised, you know, given that the cost of the project is still estimated at roughly $1.4 billion. And, you know, officials had previously said that any additional undergrounding would really make the cost skyrocket. Some people are asking, you know, if it's not putting a huge increase in the cost, why not bury more? And so I think so those are some of the questions we'll have going forward.
Well, and Ken Kimball, how much does this satisfy the concerns that your group, the AMC, has had? Is this a lot better, a little better, Ken, or not much better at all?
Well, I think the short answer to that, Laura, is this is an important first step, but it's a first step. What we're really discussing here is what the landscape of New Hampshire will look like out into the next decades to centuries out here. And this is a long-term decision that's being made. And it's frequently framed just as an energy question. But it's also very true that we know that there are competing lines that are being proposed both in Vermont, New York, and we know worldwide that there's newer and better technologies right now that allow for a lot more burial. And so it's not just simply a question of the energy itself, but it's also the question of how can we get that energy down here in the least impact way. And burial today is not a pie in the sky. It is something that competing projects here are already putting forth. They're well advanced in their permitting. We know in Vermont, for example, the New England Clean Power Link is a total burial project. And incidentally, it also has a much bigger mitigation package and a much more focused mitigation package than what has come out today. So we are appreciative of the first steps. We also have heard in some of the press releases that they're open to further changes. And so the big question is that tweaks or is that really substantive changes between now and the time that the application comes in?
So, Bill, let's hit it right on the head. If you can bury 60 miles of lines, why not bury the whole almost 200?
Yes. So, Laura, we believe the plan we announced earlier this week strikes the appropriate balance. The balance we've attempted to strike is one between a project that works technically, one that's siteable here in New Hampshire, meaning it protects the most treasured areas of the state, and then one which is affordable, meaning it's not cost prohibitive. As to the technical side, you know, Ken mentioned state-of-the-art technology. We did announce a change to advanced cable technology earlier this week. When we install 60 miles of it underground here in New Hampshire, it will be the longest underground installation in North America. You know, as far as siteability, those critical views in New Hampshire, we've listened to New Hampshire. That's why we selected the White Mountain National Forest, the Franconia Notch area, the Appalachian Trail, and addressed that by going underground in those regions. And then really it comes down to the question of, you know, is it an affordable project? We think we've struck the right balance among those three critical variables.
The Vermont example that Ken mentions has been mentioned by others. I'm sure you're familiar with this, Bill, where the company developing that project, the Clean Power Link, is going to bury all 154 miles. So not just eliminating the view issues, but maybe saving money because you won't have outages and repairs to those above ground lines due to severe weather. A lot of people are making this comparison, Bill, between Northern Pass and then this underground Vermont Clean Power Link. Is it a fair comparison or not?
Several distinguishing characteristics. One, that project is going largely through Lake Champlain, so it's not technically underground, it's underwater. Very different installation process. Second, and I think this is what distinguishes Northern Pass in a positive way, is our relationship with Hydro-Québec. Hydro-Québec controls, meaning it owns and operates all of the hydro generation in the portion of Canada from which we are going to import it. We have a partnership with Hydro-Québec that is exclusive at this point. The developer of that project does not have a relationship with Hydro-Québec. Another important fact is that there needs to be a transmission line built on the Canadian side of the border from that generation to interconnect to whatever project in New England brings it into the New England market. The only project being cited in Canada to provide for an interconnection is the one Hydro-Québec is moving forward with to interconnect with Northern Pass. So the projects in Vermont and New York that Ken referred to essentially don't have a power supply, and they don't have a way to get any power to the U.S. border for importation. And then I think it's important to recognize that it's not truly an underground project. It's underwater, and it's a big distinction.
What do you think, Ken? And then let's go to our listeners.
Well, that's only partly true because the project in Vermont does go underneath Lake Champlain. There's no question that that's a truism. But then it does move from Lake Champlain all the way down to the southeast corner of Vermont, and that is all on State of Vermont roadways, which is very similar to this project. There's also the Champlain-Hudson project, which goes down Lake Champlain but then jumps over and goes underwater for part of the way in the Hudson River, but then because of PCB contamination jumps up and actually is proposed to go a considerable distance above ground in railway and in road right-of-ways.
Do you want to jump in, Sam Evans-Brown?
Yeah, I just wanted to make a real quick point that the underground versus underwater distinction, the reason that's so important is that the process for burying a line on sediments on the lake floor is much simpler than the process of burying along state roads. As opposed to going in with excavators and digging a trench, they've got these sort of nifty trenching robots that dig with a water jet and the sediment just sort of drifts in over top of the line. So it really does simplify and reduce costs to have it underwater for that 100 plus or 100 some odd miles going down through Lake Champlain. So comparing the costs of Northern Pass to burying the Clean Power Link, it's really tough to do. They've got a much simpler route, which begs the question I think that Ken was alluding to at the beginning. Is it even a good idea to go through New Hampshire? Opponents say it's not. Let's go for the simplest routes. Northern Pass has and continues to say that this is a good project still.
Our phone number here in the exchange, 1-800-892-6477. Join us by email, exchange@nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. And let's go first to Michael in Londonderry. Hi, Michael. You're on the exchange. Go ahead.
Good morning.
First
and foremost, I think Eversource recently, with the announcement while I'm a part of the training program, has made a fantastic adjustment from the standpoint where I'm an avid hiker. I've done Arethusa Falls multiple times, Mount Washington, and I think burying the structure through that section was really a great bit of corporate responsibility on their part. And in terms of the training, I think it's really good for everybody because not do you just get the experience, the electrical background, but it fills in a lot of certain manufacturing holes that exist in New Hampshire for skilled labor that our manufacturers are having a tough time furnishing and supplying that labor force.
Okay, so you're talking about the jobs and the training aspect of this, Michael, it sounds like, right?
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah. Okay, and Michael, thank you for the call. Allie, people are excited about the jobs. We've heard from unions and so forth that think that this is a good thing. And from what I understand, burial would mean even more jobs.
Yeah, that's correct. A federal study that came out recently showed that burying the line would create more jobs both in the short term and in the long term. And the Eversource and Northern Pass has committed to hiring locally and training people here. That's part of, you know, as Sam mentioned, there's part of a bigger deal, $200 million as well, that would be allocated to communities along the line for community betterment, tourism. So they have tried to make some concessions to make communities that may not see burial as they had wanted happy with the project as well.
All right. Well, coming up, we will talk more about this. We'll take more of your questions and comments. Michael, thank you for that one. The exchange number is 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. More in a moment. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, the latest on the Northern Pass project, including a new proposal to bury more lines and offer other incentives to affected communities. Let's hear from you this hour. Your questions, comments, thoughts are welcome at 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. Again, 1-800-892-6477. Email is exchange@nhpr.org. And let's go, all of you, next to Columbia, where Russ is on the line. Hi, Russ. Go ahead. You're on the exchange.
Hi. Good morning.
Morning.
Thank you. I live up in northern Coos County, and although it's recommendable that they're going to bury that power line down through the White Mountains, there's an awful lot of New Hampshire that's north of the White Mountains in the northern Coos County. And these areas are going to be severely impacted by the towers. We were amongst the first groups, all the towns up here, checking in early when this process first started, and all the towns have voted against the project to start off with, and I don't think anybody has changed their minds at this point. They're talking about the cost of burial. The White Mountain National Park is mostly rock, and up here there's lots of rock, but obviously it's not mountainous as the White Mountain National Park, so I think it's the cost of burial would be even less north in northern Coos County than it would be going through the White Mountains.
Russ, how would you feel about this project if the whole thing were buried?
If they would have saved themselves a bunch of years, then I can see the same thing is going to apply going forward if they just started this thing correctly to begin with.
Okay.
Their first proposal, nobody knew about it until all of a sudden they read it in the local newspapers up here in Colebrook, and they were going to go right down through all the neighborhoods in Columbia and Colebrook and down through the White Mountains that way.
Okay. And Russ, thank you so much for calling. Couple points to follow up on there. Bill, to you first, I think, you know, just the idea that people are still skeptical of your claim that you can't bury the whole thing.
Yeah, so specifically in the North Country, you know, we've got an intense focus on improving this project to address issues in the North Country. So previously we had announced a major change to the project route, which moved in the North Country a lot of the project, 40 miles of it, basically eastward. We've also agreed to bury 8 miles underground. In the North Country. In moving east, we moved out of towns such as Colebrook into an area referred to as the Wagner Forest, which is essentially a working or an industrial forest, not many folks there. So if you think about the 40 miles that the listener was referring to, 8 of them are underground, 24 are now in the Wagner Forest, and the remaining 8 we are essentially working structure by structure, town by town to address visual impacts. I will say, just to clarify, in the area of the White Mountain National Forest, we will not actually be burying this underground through the forest. It will be in state roadways. Just to clarify, it's not as if we're going through the granite that the listener was referring to.
And that then makes as far it a little as easier.
It does. Far, yeah. Far different. And then finally, as to North Country support, you know, I had the pleasure the other evening in making a similar announcement in Coos County, and the amount of support was overwhelming. You know, there were at least 150 attendees at this event. A wide range of North Country stakeholders, local contractors who would benefit from the project, elected officials, small business owners, just concerned citizens. It was truly impressive. So I do think this announcement has gone a long way to addressing the North Country issues. We're going to continue to have a focus in the North Country.
Sam, what about Russ's broader point, too, that just the rollout of this thing 5 years ago, it's been kind of herky-jerky. And some have said that the project's success might have been better if it had been handled in a better way with the public.
Certainly, Russ is not the first one to make that point. Notably, a Boston Globe editorial a couple of years ago, which supported the project, made that same point that you know, I think the phrase was they've made every misstep imaginable or something like that. So Russ is not the first to observe that. I think that, you know, if you were to look at this through sort of a negotiation framework, you start with your toughest offer, right? And then as you soften them, each successive step that you take, each successive concession makes the project look better. So one could read it that way. I would say that one quick point in terms of the burial through the White Mountain National Forest, the White Mountain National Forest needed to sign off on this project. And there have been a lot of folks pointing to the impacts there as a potential deal breaker for the project. So I think that if you were to look at this, it's no surprise that that's where the burial that they have proposed is. But that's you know, we'll see going forward if concerns like Russ's will get more concessions.
Okay, and Allie, and then I have another question for you, Ken, too. Go ahead.
Yeah, I think it's important to note, too, that while public support and, you know, comment is important, it's not like Northern Pass has to get town-by-town approval to actually get this project through. They need approval from the Federal Department of Energy, and they also need state approval from what's called the Site Evaluation Committee. It's a board of about 9 people, state officials, some public members, and they sort of act like the statewide planning board. So, you know, if towns have concerns, they submit them to the SEC, but ultimately it's not lawmakers or the public that makes a decision. It's these two oversight committees.
Well, and a question for you, Ken, regarding our earlier caller, Michael, who said he was happy about the jobs this project would bring, happy about the cash for North Country economic development. As someone who lives in the North Country, and we all know that there's been, you know, lots of economic struggles there, what do you say to those who say, look, we need this thing for jobs, for our livelihood. We're losing young people. This could help.
Well, I guess you could take a very simple answer to that question, because if you take a look at the draft EIS, to get from the border down to where the burial starts is approximately 80 miles. If they actually buried it coming starting at Route 3 and came down to where the burial starts, it reduces the actual distance you would need to go to around 64, 65 miles plus or minus. It's hard to get the exact numbers, but essentially you reduce the distance. As Ali pointed out earlier, there's actually more jobs. So I can't think of a better win-win for the North Country where you would get more jobs, have shorter distances, and essentially make the impact evaporate.
Again, the number here in the exchange is 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. Here's an email that came in earlier from Frank in Manchester, who says, it's a fact that energy costs in New Hampshire are high, and with the retirement of generating capacity in our region, costs are likely to go much higher. Frank says, the new Eversource proposal unveiled Tuesday not only recognizes this fact, it will create jobs and bring clean, reliable energy to our state while addressing environmental concerns. Frank says this is an important project that needs to move forward if we want to remain competitive, attract and keep businesses, and create economic opportunity. I guess that's what you already talked about, but I'll throw that again to you, Ken. You know, there are folks who say, look, the energy costs are killing our state, they're killing our businesses, and we got to do something, and this is a good deal.
Well, I think it can be a better deal is the short answer. I think the public and other projects have exhibited that this project could move forward with a lot less impact than what we're seeing right now. So when it gets down to just simply the price of power, you also have to ask is what is the price to New Hampshire's landscape at the same time? And that's where the balance question is really coming from. A lot of people oppose this project as the way that it's being proposed to be developed right now, which is different than to say that they entirely oppose having Hydro-Québec power come down.
That's the issue then, the project itself. You're not necessarily opposed to hydropower per se.
No. Actually, our organization sits on the Low Impact Hydro Institute. I'm a board member of it, which certifies what is classified as green hydropower here in the United States. It's actually used as part of Massachusetts renewable portfolio standards.
Can we talk about that a little bit, folks? And maybe to you first, Sam, there's been a lot about, you know, debate back and forth. Is hydropower really green or not? I've got an email here from Catherine. Lots of points, but I'll share this one. She says the project does nothing to help New Hampshire reach its climate and renewable energy goals. She says large hydroelectric projects like those built by Hydro-Québec are environmentally devastating, destroying vast acres of forest. And Sam, the more you look into this, you know, it does seem like when these water flows are disrupted, a lot of methane is released. Methane, we now hear, is worse than carbon. So how do we, the general public, assess the greenness of these large hydropower projects?
Certainly the environmental community for a long time has had real problems with large-scale hydro. The question is, this is existing hydropower that's up in Canada, and a lot of the impacts exist already. It's simply taking advantage of it in times of year when it's not being used by Canada. Their peak is in the winter, ours is in the summer. So that's one argument. The sort of counterpoint to that is the export market to New England incentivizing Hydro-Québec to build more new hydropower?
And there are and a number more of, impacts.
There are a number of projects that are sort of in the works and they're working their way through. There's pushback within Canada to those happening as well. So it's an open question as to how much new development this is actually going to drive. So that's sort of the back and forth. And if you were look at, I mean, if we're talking about climate impacts, if you look at the lifetime carbon impact of a dam, it is still much lower than a fossil fuel plant. It's you know, in Canada's boreal forest, they have to flood a lot of land compared to some, you know, sort of ideal hydro projects. But even so, this is cleaner than natural gas if you're looking purely at carbon and, you know, equivalent methane emissions.
Well, and a related question for you, Bill, given extreme water shortages and droughts that we're seeing in other parts of the country, just this morning we hear that parts of California are sinking because they've had to suck up so much water from underground. How confident are you about the future of hydropower in general? Is this really the right avenue to take at this point in time?
Yeah, we're very confident as to the reliability not only of the hydropower from Canada, but also the system to deliver it to the United States. You know, on these earlier points about the economic and environmental impacts of this project, I mean, with respect to large-scale hydro, look at the most recently released Clean Power Plan by the Obama administration. They specifically recognize the critical role of large-scale hydro in meeting this country's environmental objectives. You know, this project alone will deliver over 3 million tons per year of carbon dioxide reductions for New England. We've additionally, and Sam mentioned this earlier, announced the upgrade of the so-called COAS loop, which is up in the North Country, which will unlock over approximately 100 megawatts of small-scale renewable generation and allow it to get to market. Now we're talking about wind power, biomass projects, small-scale hydro here in New Hampshire. So the combined effect of those two projects, the Northern Pass and the COAS loop upgrade, there's nothing like it that's going to deliver the environmental benefit for this state and this region. As to the economics, from an energy cost perspective, which was mentioned earlier, we're estimating $800 million in energy cost savings for businesses and residences here in New Hampshire over the first 10 years, which is critically important to the businesses that were mentioned by that caller. You know, we've heard loud and clear by manufacturers and other businesses across the state that energy costs are a drag on their competitiveness. They have to be lowered, and they have to be more stable. This project goes a long way to answering that issue.
And Billick and Ken, I can see you want to jump in. Go ahead.
Yes. There's no question that hydro has less greenhouse gas emissions than natural gas or others. But I think we have to also be careful about how these numbers are calculated because they can be inflated. The draft EIS said 2.8. The most recent announcements from them is 3 million. And it's very hard to figure out how they've actually even calculated these numbers. But it looks like the way that they're being calculated is asking just how much natural gas would be displaced on this side. The atmosphere does the calculations a little bit different. It goes up in and asks how much methane is also being emitted. And the draft EIS does not jump across the border, and these numbers don't appear to jump across the border. But hydro projects vary as to how much they emit. These are some of the highest emitting greenhouse gas types of hydropower that you can get.
These Hydro-Québec projects.
That is correct. You have a lot of boreal soils that are flooded. You create an anaerobic environment, and you get a lot of methane release. And methane is a gas that's about 70 times more potent as a greenhouse gas than carbon dioxide. So when you take a look at the real numbers out there, this type of hydro project is one-third to two-thirds of the same emissions of a natural gas power plant. So the 3 million ton number, unless the public can actually look at those numbers, may be quite a bit higher, because if it's just simply based on how much gas is removed on the ISO circuit, you'll get a different number than if you actually go back.
ISO meaning ISO New England, the independent system operator.
Much.
Yeah, so I guess.
So there's a lot of invisible numbers that are still out here. And that's part of the challenge I think the public is still having in accepting some of the numbers that are out there, because a lot of the numbers that are going in to create these things are still invisible to the public.
So just to summarize on this point then, Ken, in terms of how green is hydro, you're just saying it depends.
It depends
on the project. It depends on how it's done, where it takes place, and so forth.
If you take a run-of-river project like on the Androscoggin, the greenhouse gas emissions are almost nil.
All right. Let's go back to our listeners. Lots of people who want to jump in our conversation. The exchange number is 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org, 1-800-892-6477. And Jerry's calling from Stewartstown. Hi, Jerry. You're on the air. Welcome. Jerry in Stewartstown, he's still with us. Hey,
Hi.
Good morning.
Hello. Good morning. My name's Harry Brown. I live up at Diamond Pond in Stewartstown. My comment is that I'm the president of the New Hampshire Off-Highway Vehicle Association, and while the association has never taken a position pro or con Northern Pass, we, the riders of OHRVs, snowmobiles, et cetera, don't have a problem utilizing power lines. We presently utilize them throughout the state of New Hampshire, Vermont, Maine, for our recreation. And we also believe that because we already use them, that tourism and recreation will not be negatively impacted by the power lines, exactly the opposite, actually. So we are supportive of using the power lines for our recreation. And the Ride the Wild up in Coos County is basically the only strong economic initiative that's occurring in Coos County, and that is OHRV riding.
So a dual benefit there, Jerry, you're saying, for ATV riders.
ATV and snowmobilers, absolutely.
Okay, thanks for calling in. And let's take another call, also from the North Country. This is Julie in Colebrook. Hi, Julie. Go ahead. You're on the exchange.
Hi, Laura. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I love your show.
Good.
I called because I wanted to say that, you know, I have been vehemently against the Northern Pass since it started. And number one, it was going right through my neighborhood. They did change that, but they haven't changed the fact of full burial. So when we first did this, the whole North Country was against the whole Northern Pass completely. And we agreed to go with our friends in the South and say, okay, we'll go for burial and we'll compromise some. And so that's what the opposition has been saying. Bury the thing and you lose the opposition.
That's the bottom line for you, Julie.
Exactly. And, you know, so I wanted to address the other things that were just talked about just recently, too. But so in the end, if they would just bury this, everybody would stop complaining and stop messing with it.
Okay.
Now, the COAS loop is another thing. I don't know if they have to do that above ground so that people can tie into it or not, but I don't think that's – I think that's something they could explore. If the COAS loop has to be above ground so that the small energy producers can tie into it, then that may be a possibility to keep that above ground. But otherwise, if they give New Hampshire price guarantees on the power and they give New Hampshire – some money and stuff like that for the inconvenience that it's causing us and the loss in our property values and everything, and they bury it, then they're not going to have any complaints here.
All right. Yeah. And, Julie, I'm going to jump in on you just because we're heading into a break. Bill, that sounds like one for you. Price guarantees on the power, which I think you guys have included in this new plan.
Yeah, so as to the power, we certainly have are in a position to announce, which we did earlier this week, a power purchase agreement with Hydro-Quebec, which will provide price stability and a lowering of cost. So I think that is satisfied. You know, the broader question goes back to the question, to the point I stressed at the outset, which is the need for balance. We are working towards a solution that is affordable and delivers substantial benefits to New Hampshire. We believe, we're very confident of this, that we've struck the right balance now with today's proposal. You know, there is a the point that Ken was mentioning about the need for the project to work technically. We need to keep that in mind. As I said earlier, this will be the longest installation of underground construction of this cable in North America. And we were happy and excited to announce that earlier this week.
Well, and Sam, I'll go to you after a short break. And then Allie Morris, looking to you to update us on the impact on central New Hampshire, including the Concord area. More in a moment. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, we're getting the latest on the Northern Pass Project. Given a new plan from the project's backers that includes burial of more lines, you can join us, 1-800-892-6477. Your questions and comments about this project and the latest plan from Eversource are welcome at 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. And Sam Evans Brown, just before the break, we had a call from Julie in Colebrook, who had some concerns and mentioned price guarantees on the power. Bill Quinlan from Eversource told us that this new deal does include some price guarantees. I'd love your thoughts there as well.
Yeah, so again, the details have been a little thin. I'm sure we'll see more coming out in the near future. But basically, 10% of the power across the line is going to be purchased by Eversource for New Hampshire customers. What we know is that that's firm power, which means they can schedule it. It comes when they're looking for it, as opposed to just whenever Hydro-Quebec wants to send it. And we've been told it's advantageously priced, although we don't know exactly what that price is. You can look across the border to Vermont, where they have a long-term purchase power agreement with Hydro-Quebec, and it is relatively inexpensive. I mean, they're looking at like 5.8 cents a kilowatt hour, which is below market, certainly, at this point. So we'll see the agreement when it comes out, and we can get a sense of that. But it's a 20-year agreement, and it also includes the environmental attributes of the power, which I think you should look at this as a way for Eversource to satisfy the mandates of the Renewable Greenhouse Gas Initiative. They have to cut the carbon of their generation in general, and so I think this is their plan for doing that.
And New Hampshire also, Sam, has a renewable portfolio standard. I think Governor Lynch put that in.
We do have a renewable portfolio standard. I think under current law is not going to help them satisfy that because
really?
Hydropower is not classified as renewable energy under the RPS. So there have been states that have looked to add that in, and certainly Ken has talked about that. But in New Hampshire, that has not gone through as of yet.
That's really interesting. I did not know that. Ali, I wanted to turn to you because we spent a lot of the last segment focusing on the North Country, and that's appropriate. That's where a lot of the opposition has come. But, you know, central New Hampshire, Pittsfield, Deerfield, Concord, all these central New Hampshire communities will be affected as well, and I'm hoping you can give us an update there.
Yeah, definitely. So I think it is interesting. UNH has done some polling on the Northern Pass, and you consistently find that people in the southern tier of the state know less about the project. And, you know, there is quite a big section that's coming down from Franklin to Deerfield. It's going to pass about 8 miles through Concord. And that route is going to be an existing Eversource rights of way, which means that there's already power lines standing there. But I think, you know, what some people don't recognize is that, you know, especially through Concord, the average height of those towers right now is about 43 feet. You know, if Northern Pass comes through, that tower height average will jump to about 88 feet, with the tallest being 120 feet. And so, you know, I think we'll see, you know, as the project continues to go through and there weren't really many changes to the southern part of the line, communities have voiced concerns about it. Concord has a specific committee that will be working to try to figure out their plans around Northern Pass. And I think we'll see some of the more southern communities getting more involved now that it's a final proposal moving through.
Now that there's more something specific to look at. And just some detail, Ali, please. When we talk about the towers and you mentioned them being higher than what we have now in the Concord area, I read somewhere that, at least in parts of this project, the towers themselves have changed. They're not going to be those big steel lattice-looking structures. They'll be more typical poles. Is that the case for the whole project or just pieces of it?
I believe it's the northern part of the project. About 140 of the lattice structures are going to be converted to the monopole, the single pole. And also in the northern section, because they reduce the size of the line, they're going to be able to lower some of those tower heights, I think an average of about 5 to 10 feet. So that was one of the mitigation plans.
Can you jump in on that, Bill? And again, speaking of someone who lives in the Concord area, I'm interested as to what this would look like, you know, in our own backyard here.
Yeah, so the way we're making the decisions around where to use, you know, conventional lattice structures and where to use the monopoles, which are the streamlined poles, is looking at public places. Ali's correct. We've identified 140 poles where we're going to currently use monopole. About 100 of them are in the North Country. 40 of those monopoles will be in the southern portion of the route that we're talking about now. Through Concord, we are in an existing right-of-way running parallel to an existing line, but we are working very closely with the committee that Ali referred to, as well as others in Concord, as basically a structure-by-structure design, location. You know, what can we do to mitigate visual impacts in this area? So while it's in an existing right-of-way, we're still taking very seriously the need to address view issues, not just in Concord, but in the entire southern portion of the route.
What do you think about this, Ken, the idea that a lot of the attention has been focused on the North Country? Are you folks in the North Country who have long been opposed to this, you know, looking to build allegiances with people down south? Or do you see the southern tier, like the Manchester business community, for example, has been on board with this? How do you see that sort of north-south thing working out?
Well, first off, AMC's key focus is on and trying to protect some of the remaining open spaces that we have. It's a diminishing resource, and, you know, projects of this type is not only the transmission itself, but what is happening in Canada constantly chips away at the remaining open spaces we have and essentially converts them into more of an industrial thing. Relative to your question on the southern part of the state here, many of our members live down here. They go up to the Whites or to the North Country to recreate. And it is understandable why people are still concerned about this in their backyard. It's sort of like having a nice little white picket fence, which is your existing thing, about the same height as your shrubs. And now you've converted it over to something that's twice as high and becomes a chain link kind of fence. And it becomes much more noticeable. And so it's understandable why those who live down here, when you get down here, it's more about the personal daily interactions of seeing this type of thing and how it affects the quality of living that you have. When you move to the North Country, it's focused more on how you're going to convert a natural landscape.
Well, and here's one more question for you that sprang to mind when Sam was talking about the renewable portfolio standard and the pressure that people in New Hampshire feel to move away from fossil fuels, given the concerns about climate, given the concerns about carbon. So question for you, Ken. You know, some have said, look, you know, New Hampshire needs to expand its energy base. We need to move away from fossil fuels. Right now, we are over-reliant on natural gas, which is still a fossil fuel. So at some point, opponents of this project, you know, need to put forward their own ideas. You know, all right, you can't just keep saying no.
The debate to this point has really been one-sided, and it's only looked at the supply side. There's an interesting thing, and it's not even listed in the draft EIS, but the state of New Hampshire just went through developing an energy strategy for the next 10 years. What's the focus in that? It's energy efficiency. It's distributed generation. It's to get away from this long distance, you know, being the old business model that we have. We know that solar is making huge gains right now. So I think as we approach this problem, we actually have to ask is how is this impacting the need to get to energy efficiency? We have all of these goals, but when you turn around and you ask, do we have any laws about energy efficiency, which is one of the cheapest, it's the most environmentally benign, and it also creates jobs. If you want to get out there and insulate your houses and so forth, these are jobs that the common person here that works in New Hampshire can get. And so it's a good question, but this needs to look at those issues. We asked the Department of Environmental the Department of Energy to look at that. They said that they wouldn't the addendum. When you turn around and you look at the draft EIS, they totally dropped it. You
don't the issue of efficiency and how much that could contribute.
And looking at the demand side, you can look at changes in rate structures, et cetera, as ways of greatly reducing demand out there. But this whole debate is focused in on how do we continue to use the old model of as long as it's demand, we'll keep developing infrastructure. And I would also point out that a lot of this infrastructure that is developed is only used a small proportion of the time. The demand is not always up at these peak hours, which is what everybody talks about. And there are different strategies of getting at this than outside of just trying to continually build more and more.
Here's a question that also comes to mind. I'll throw this to you, Bill Quinlan. Our caller, Julie, earlier said what a lot of folks have said this hour, you know, bury these lines 100% and the problems go away, to quote Julie. Eversource has said that this is too expensive. But when this new plan came out to bury 50-some-odd more lines, the cost didn't seem to go up that much. So help us figure this out.
Yeah, so it's very clear that it's more costly to move forward with underground construction. One of the things that is lost in the announcement is the fact that we have scaled the project down by approximately 20%. So while we...
In terms of megawatts.
In terms of megawatts and project size. So, and we're using a different cable technology. The other thing that is important to understand is we are now refining our cost estimates, and we haven't released yet the new cost estimate. We expect it to be in the $1.4 billion range, which was our prior cost estimate. There might be some upward pressure, but it is fundamentally a smaller project.
So costs did not soar when you decided to bury more lines because of the reduced megawattage? Is that what you're saying?
The reduced size of the project, the different cable technology, and the different technology that we're using on some of the other major components like a converter to convert from AC current to DC current. All of these have cost impacts, and we are, as we speak, working through the final cost estimation. One thing to refer to is the Department of Energy's review. They drew the conclusion that underground construction is twice the cost of above-ground construction. And they were actually factoring in the change in size of the project.
Would your maintenance costs, though, overall go down if it were underground because you don't have to worry about ice storms and, wind storms and all that?
Yeah. The lines we're referring to here, which are, high-voltage transmission lines, are highly reliable. They have sufficient right-of-way that they're not generally impacted by weather, so the maintenance costs are modest over time relative to what you're probably thinking of, which is a distribution line that is exposed to a lot of tree interruptions and the like. I will like to comment just back on one of the points Ken made, which is the importance of energy efficiency and distributed generation. We certainly are very strong supporters of both.
Distributed generation means more local
generation
projects.
Yes. Yes. In fact, New England is leading the country in energy efficiency. Massachusetts is the most energy efficient state in the union. Connecticut is not far behind, and those are states that we serve. So we are doing a lot in that space. But the fundamental issue is we need more baseload generation. Baseload generation to replace coal plants, oil plants, nuclear plants that are retiring. The trend has been to replace all of that with new baseload natural gas plants. So we're becoming very dependent on a single fuel source.
Overly dependent.
Some would say today it's over 50%. It's heading up. So hydropower, particularly the firm type of power that Sam was referring to, which is available when we need it, as much as we need, up to 1,000 megawatts in this instance, is an important part of the mix. And that's not to say there's not an important role for energy and efficiency and distributed generation, but that is not going to replace baseload power plants.
Sam, go ahead. I just wanted to make a note about the state's 10-year strategy, which does rely very heavily on energy efficiency, as Ken alluded to. The problem is that that is a document that does not have teeth. And the question is, how does that become reality?
It's aspirational.
Yeah. And so, you know, so far since that has been released, there's been basically no action by state lawmakers that has resulted in any sort of substantive changes to our current regime of energy efficiency programs. It's not clear if that's something that maybe will take a couple of years to develop, but you know, talking about energy efficiency is great, but it's the market needs to be changed in some way by legislators in order for that to happen. There's also it could also happen by regulators, but haven't seen a whole heck of a lot of action there recently either. So I think it's sort of watch this space. And we'll see if there's any sort of major push from policymakers to make that change.
I think it's more than policymakers, but it would be a question back to like Eversource is, would you really be willing to go in and champion for legislation that would set very high specific targets in this area? It's the same thing that's happening with distributed generation, where as more and more people are putting solar on their house, including myself, you know, folks have moved from being consumers to producers. And what we really need is a paradigm shift here where these things are really embedded in law the way that some of these other things are that are pushing still the old model of just, you know, large-scale generation and then long-distance transmission.
Yeah, Quick question for you, Bill. Yeah, go ahead.
If I may, on energy efficiency, Eversource has been a strong proponent for energy efficiency across New England. Currently, we're investing $500 million a year in energy efficiency programs, predominantly in Massachusetts and Connecticut, where the regulatory structure and the rate structure matches the public policy objectives. And we've been a big part of driving that reality. The other reality is, notwithstanding all of that investment in energy efficiency, load continues to grow. Customer demand continues to grow. More modestly than it would without energy efficiency, but it's still growing. So we need energy sources now, new large-scale energy sources to replace what's retiring and to deliver the rate stability and the lower prices that customers are demanding.
Well, it's a long road forward, or maybe not so long. I don't know. What's the timetable in your best-case scenario, Bill, that this thing is up and running?
Early in 2019.
And Ali Morris, you cover the State House. What's been the political reaction among the state's leaders to this new proposal put out by Eversource?
Yeah, you know, you see a lot of the senators and representatives who had previously supported the project reiterating that, and a lot of those opposed also reiterating their opposition. We did see Senate President Chuck Morris come out in favor of the proposal, but he lives in Salem, which is far from the reach of the project. And so, you know, I think that, as I mentioned earlier, while politicians can really help shape public support, they don't actually have a say determining whether this gets permitted or not. They can certainly try to create laws to make it easier, make it harder, but they won't actually vote on whether to approve this.
Well, I'm glad you said that, because we should probably finish on that point. You know, there are a lot of people voicing support or opposition to this. Whose support or opposition, Ali, really counts in terms of, you know, a yes vote or a no vote for this project?
Yeah, I think what will be really interesting to watch is the State Site Evaluation Committee, which is the state permitting group. Lawmakers just rearranged that group of committee members, and so it now includes public members. There was quite a kerfuffle over actually getting those people on the board, but now they have three public members. And they will have to look at whether it's in the public interest for this project to come through. So that could be an interesting question as we move ahead.
So how do you define the public interest, and who is the public? Do they take comments from people? I mean, are they required to listen to regular folks?
Yeah, they definitely do. And over the next few weeks, Eversource and Northern Pass will actually be holding meetings, public meetings, in all five counties where the project will pass through. That's part of the permitting process, and they'll collect, you know, public feedback there and answer questions for people in all regions where this project is.
Okay. Well, Allie, thank you for being with us. We really appreciate it.
Sure.
Allie Morris with the Concord Monitor. Ken Kimball, thank you for making the trip down.
Thanks a lot, Laura.
That's Kim Kimball. He is Director of Research for the Appalachian Mountain Club. Bill Quinlan, good to see you. Thank you for being here.
Yes, thank you, Laura.
Bill Quinlan, President of New Hampshire Operations for Eversource, and Sam Evans-Brown, you're always helping us out. Thank you.
Glad to be here.
Sam Evans-Brown, NHPR's Environment Reporter. The Exchange is a production of NHPR. The engineer is Dan Colgan. The senior producer is Ellen Grimm. Our producer is Faith Meixel. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord, and I'm Laura Knight.